analyst and author from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yikovet Tabway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم فكن تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories this hour. A rights organization says over 18,000 Yemenis, including thousands of children, have been killed as a result of the Saudi-led war on the country. A new study shows Brexit has worsened a shortage of doctors in Britain, with an estimated shortfall of 4,000 in major specialty areas from EU countries. And Belgian police clash with a group of football fans in Brussels following Morocco's win over Belgium in the Qatar World Cup. Hello and welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. An organization observing human rights situation in Yemen has released shocking figures documenting the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition during its aggression there. The Eye of Humanity Center for Human Rights and Development says more than 18,000 people have been killed in nearly 8 years of war on Yemen. That includes nearly 4,800 children. The center says nearly 600,000 homes have also been destroyed during the war. It adds that universities, schools, mosques, airports, power stations, factories, and medical facilities were completely destroyed during the aggression. Many of those public places were prime targets of the coalition's warplanes. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war in Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Riyadh has defied international calls to stop the deadly aggression and blockade. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry warns about more incursions into Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers under the upcoming Israeli coalition cabinet. The ministry said any Israeli attempt to change the status quo of Al-Aqsa will have damaging consequences for the regime. It called on Arab and Islamic countries to provide the necessary international protection for occupied Al-Quds and its sanctities. The ministry's warning came after scores of Israeli settlers broke into the Al-Aqsa compound again under the protection of the regime's forces. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has already warned Israel against crossing red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. On the occasion of Basij Week, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has addressed members of the volunteer force. Basij, which is affiliated to Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, has been at the forefront of confronting rioters in the country. In his speech, the leader said that negotiating with the U.S. won't resolve anything, adding that Iran's main confrontation is with the global hegemony, not a bunch of rioters.
Oh. It was an important forum, comprised of volunteer forces that have been at the forefront in confronting the rioters. The all-too-important besieged force, which throughout the decades have not only served in the security arena, have contributed to Iran's advancements in a host of fields like science and technology. Iran's leader, in his address to them for the occasion of Besiege Week, said that these forces have sacrificed themselves in order to save people from a bunch of rioters and mercenaries. But he also advised them on who the real enemy is, that in the bigger picture, Iran's battle is not with a group of rioters, but with global hegemony. The onslaught on Iran, especially through the media, has been organized by foreign actors, like from Saudi Arabia and the UK. With US and Israel aiding and abetting their fake news, the primary goal has been to create unrest inside of Iran by inviting Iranians to come out and protest. At the same time, there are some under the misguided belief that talking to the U.S. will solve Iran's problems.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
But Iran's leader has said that negotiating will not resolve anything, saying that our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom.
Iran has held several rounds of talks with the West over its civilian nuclear program, but the negotiations have not yielded the results Tehran wants. The main reason has been the U.S.'s excessive demands and its lack of will to compromise. The U.S. wants to strip Iran of all of its capabilities, which includes its nuclear knowledge and defense capabilities, like missiles.
There have been lots of speculations as to why the riots began in the first place, especially the timing, which came when the JCPOA sanctions removal talks with world powers were deadlocked over Washington's lack of commitment. It is a distinct possibility that the recent riots may have been part of the West's pressure on Iran to compromise on its rights in negotiations, including with the U.S. Yet the whole notion on continuing with these talks is not in the best interest of Iran, and can never bear fruit due to the West and U.S.'s excessive demands. Realistically, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, to change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside of its borders, and to close its defense industries, basically stripping the country of its identity. Some of these restrictions and excessive demands are due to Israel, which acts in line with U.S. policies to maintain dominance over the region. After all, the U.S. has worked hard to vilify Iran through Iranophobia in the region, pushing Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel to unite against regional power, Iran. That is one of the reasons that Iran has time and again said that the U.S. must leave the West Asia region, as it only seeks to weaken and ultimately disintegrate Muslim countries, as stated by advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati. The U.S. has played a destructive role in the region, like pushing hard for the partitioning of Iraq and Syria, trying to do the same with Iran. This has been a goal of the U.S., a West Asia region whose borders can be redrawn to their liking, with the ultimate goal of having vassal states serving U.S. interests. But when it comes to Iran, that will be an impossible feat. One only has to look at the most recent showing of Iranians when it came to their large-scale presence earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, and for the funeral of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, whom the U.S. assassinated back in 2020 from a drone strike in Baghdad, not to mention the funeral processions which Iranians participated in the funerals held in Karaj, Isfahan, and Shiraz.
A study shows Brexit has compounded a shortage of doctors in Britain, with an estimated shortfall of 4,000 in major specialty areas from European Union countries. The study by the Nutfield Trust, an independent health think tank, indicates the UK relied upon European doctors in several fields of medicine before leaving the bloc. But it suggests the recruitment of European medical staff has slowed down, falling below the projected increase. The survey shows if the pre-Brexit trend continued, there should have been more than 41,000 doctors from the EU or the European Free Trade Association registered in 2021. This comes as the crisis at the state-funded health service, NHS, struggles after years of underfinancing. Last week, the Royal College of Nursing announced that the first strike action in the union's 106-year history, citing pay, working conditions, and chronic staff shortages. Morocco's FIFA World Cup win against Belgium triggers clashes after the Moroccan community bursts into celebrations in the Belgian capital, Brussels. Dozens of fans smashed shop windows, threw fireworks, and torched vehicles. About 100 officers used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the rioters. Police say 11 people were arrested. Also, in the eastern city of Liège, a gang of 50 people attacked a police station, breaking windows and damaging two police vehicles. The police there also resorted to water cannons. Belgium is home to around 500,000 people of Moroccan descent. Morocco beat Belgium 2-0 in their World Cup face-off. Tens of thousands of supporters of Spain's far-right Vox Party have demonstrated nationwide against Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez and his leftist government. The protesters were calling on Sanchez to step down. The leader of the Vox Party denounced what he called a government of treason, insecurity, and ruin. The demonstrators are against recent changes to the criminal code and the approval of a new law against sexual violence. They say the government has authorized more lenient sentences for criminals. They believe the modified criminal code, which should be in place by the end of the year, will encourage further attempts to separate the northeastern Catalonia region from Spain. Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated. It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The South Korean government raises alert about the country's cargo transport disruption to Syria as a nationwide strike by truckers enters its fifth day. The country's transport ministry says the warning level is the highest as the walkout has negatively affected the supply chain. Construction sites also face concrete shortages. South Korea is witnessing the second major strike in less than 6 months over truckers' demands for higher wages and better working conditions. The South Korean government estimates that truckers' strike could cause losses of up to 300 billion won per day. President Yoon Suk-yeol criticized the industrial action last week, but his government says it will negotiate with the union on Monday. According to the transport ministry, container traffic at ports fell to around 8% of normal levels. South Korea's economy, which leans on exports, is expected to experience a reduction in its growth next year. For more details on that story, I'm now joined by our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, Frank Smith. Frank, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us. How serious is the disruption?
Well, I think the government really has taken a hard line with the truckers. They negotiated a deal about 5 months ago to extend what was a 3-year agreement initially made by a progressive liberal presidential administration with the truckers for a safe trucking freight rates system that would ensure that truckers weren't overworked and that they were able to drive safely with a guaranteed freight rates. And now the government is saying that they may issue a back-to-work order with the Ministry of Interior and Safety, Yi Sang Min, threatening to force the truckers back to work. They also said that they're going to deploy police to make sure that the trucker strike doesn't infringe on transportation systems in the country, and even perhaps levy fines of more than $20,000 or potentially a 3-year jail term for truckers that violate a potential back to work order. It hasn't been since something like 2004 since such a back to work order has been issued, and you know, it would be quite unprecedented if the government followed through with that.
Right. So what about the negotiations? Because Yoon Suk-yeol's government has said that it will negotiate with the truckers on Monday. What about that?
Yeah, we don't really have information about how those negotiations are coming along. The previous strike about 5 months ago lasted something like 8 days before a late night agreement was made to extend this 3-year deal until the end of the year. So really they're in sort of the last month heading into December before this safe trucking freight rate system expires. The truckers really want to see this expanded. Right now this system applies mostly to cargo drivers, to freight drivers, and to cement truck drivers. That's why, as you mentioned, it's affected the construction industry already. It's also affecting South Korea's very important steel industry. The truckers want to see this system, though, this safe freight rates system, applied to other drivers, including, for example, delivery drivers and bus drivers, to make South Korean roads safer.
And how long do you think the strike will continue?
That's really anyone's guess. We do have a conservative government in power right now, but they have been under some pressure. President Yoon Suk-yeol's approval ratings have been hovering around 35%. They have improved a little bit over the past month, but still the government's been under increasing pressure over a previous crowd crush in Itaewon in which more than 150 young people lost their lives. So the government really sort of needs some type of, you know, let's say public relations positive moving forward if it wants to see especially President Yoon Suk-yeol's administration able to pass the type of, let's say, for example, pro-business legislation perhaps later down the road.
Frank, thank you so much for the details. Frank Smith, our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul. Have a good day. Former White House official John Bolton says Republicans are ready to abandon Donald Trump for the 2024 presidential race, adding that he is acting old and tired. Bolton, who served as a national security advisor under Trump, says the party is ready to move on to a fresh face. He says some in the party have, quote, just switched Trump off in their brain after Republicans underperformed in this month's midterm elections. Bolton suggested Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as a possible Republican candidate. Trump has formally entered the race for the 2024 U.S. presidential election. Bolton is the latest ex-White House official to cast doubt about the popularity of his former boss. Some key figures in the party have blamed Trump and his endorsed candidates for the disappointing results in the midterm elections, warning that the party will lose the 2024 race if Trump is its final choice. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
European Union officials are accusing the United States of America of profiting off the Ukraine war with Russia. One senior European official recently said, America is the country that is most profiting from this war. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story. The European Union has accused the United States of profiteering from the Ukraine war by selling guns and gas at ramped-up prices. Several high-ranking European officials within the bloc accused Joe Biden of capitalizing on the war by marking up the cost of importing vital goods. One senior official told the website Politico they believe America was standing to gain the most from the continuation of the fighting, 9 months after the conflict started. The fact is, if you look at it soberly, the country that is most profiting from this war is the United States, because they are selling more gas and at higher prices, and because they're selling more weapons, the European official said. In recent months, Europeans have weaned off Russian energy and gas, with the countries forced to look to the United States for their oil. EU countries, however, pay roughly four times as much for gas as it costs in America, with cheaper energy becoming highly competitive in the States. Businesses are looking to pump cash into the United States fuel market with new investments, as some even relocate their firms to the other side of the Atlantic. It has sent some world leaders in Europe into a frenzy, with French President Emmanuel Macron recently saying it was not friendly of the United States to treat allies as it is. Meanwhile, European countries are suffering an arms shortage due to the huge shipments that have been sent to Ukraine, with them racing to replenish supplies over the winter. Yet the Americans continue to send more, with the cost of supplying Ukraine at over $19 billion, as another $400 million was added earlier this week. It comes at an already tumultuous moment between the Americans and several nations as Europe grapples with the fallout from Joe Biden's green subsidies. The Inflation Reduction Act, or so-called green subsidies, has changed everything, one EU official said. The EU official asked, "Is Washington still our ally?" Tensions came to a boil on Friday, 25th of November, as European Union trade ministers met and branded the act discriminatory, ahead of it coming into force in just over a month. The nearly $400 billion subsidy scheme introduced in the Inflation Reduction Act incentivizes Americans into buying products that are both US-made and energy-efficient. The Inflation Reduction Act provides tax credits for businesses and individuals who purchase green products, including wind turbines and electric vehicles. The credits are mostly available, however, for products made in the United States. The Inflation Reduction Act reportedly sent Brussels into full-blown panic mode, with country officials concerned over the subsidies taking away from EU products and threatening European businesses. The country recently set up a task force to look into the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act on European nations in the coming months and years. European trade ministers also gathered in Brussels on Friday to discuss the Inflation Reduction Act, but no concrete solution was found. Josef Sekela, the minister for the Czech Republic, recently said he hopes to have a solution before the EU trade ministers meet in early December. US officials have repeatedly shrugged off the concerns from the European leaders. At the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia, EU officials reportedly asked Joe Biden about the high gas prices. The American president, Joe Biden, seemed unaware of the issue. The European nations are also concerned that the US is using its quick and cheap energy practices to seduce businesses into moving from Europe into America. Website Politico has also covered this story. European Union officials attack Joe Biden over sky-high gas prices, weapons sales and trade. The Russia-Ukraine conflict is beginning to fracture the West. Top European officials are furious with Joe Biden's administration and now accuse the Americans of making a fortune from the war, while EU countries suffer. The fact is, if you look at it soberly, the country that is most profiting from this war is the United States of America, because they're selling more gas and at higher prices, and because they're selling more weapons, one senior European official told Politico. The explosive comments, backed in public and private by officials, diplomats and ministers elsewhere, follow mounting anger in Europe over American subsidies that threaten to wreck European industry. The Kremlin is likely to welcome the poisoning of the atmosphere among Western allies. We are really at a historic juncture, the senior European Union official said, arguing that the double hit of trade disruption from the US subsidies and high energy prices risk turning public opinion against both the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the transatlantic alliance. America needs to realize that public opinion is shifting in many European Union countries. Another top official, the EU's chief diplomat, Josep Borrell, called on Washington to respond to European concerns. Americans, our friends, take decisions which have an economic impact on us, Josep Borrell said. The US rejected Europe's complaints. The rising gas prices in Europe is caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict and Russia's energy war against Europe, period, a spokesperson for Joe Biden's National Security Council said. Exports of liquefied natural gas, LNG, from US to Europe increased dramatically and enabled Europe to diversify away from Russia, the National Security Council spokesperson said. The biggest point of tension in recent weeks has been Joe Biden's green subsidies and taxes that Brussels says unfairly tilt trade away from the EU and threaten to destroy European industries. Despite formal objections from Europe, Washington has so far shown no sign of backing down. At the same time, the disruption caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict is tipping European economies into recession, with inflation rocketing and a devastating squeeze on energy supplies threatening blackouts and rationing this winter. As they attempt to reduce their reliance on Russian energy, European Union countries are turning to gas from the United States instead. But the price Europeans are paying is almost four times as high as the same fuel costs in America. Then, there's the likely surge in orders for American-made military kit as European armies run short after sending weapons to Ukraine. It's all got too much for top officials in Brussels and other EU capitals. French President Emmanuel Macron said high US gas prices were not friendly. And Germany's economy minister has called on Washington to show more solidarity and help reduce energy costs.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the growing proximity between India and Israel and how Benjamin Netanyahu's comeback is being seen by Hindutva forces in India. And we shall also look at the liquefied natural gas crisis in Pakistan amid a rapid surge in global gas prices fueled by the simmering war in Ukraine.
Benjamin Netanyahu's comeback after the recently held Israeli regime elections has brought cheer to the Hindutva forces in India. Netanyahu, during his previous stint as the Israeli premier, had developed a close relationship with the Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party government in New Delhi. Political observers believe Netanyahu's comeback augurs well for the India-Israel relations, which are likely to see an upward trajectory in military and economic spheres. And most importantly, Modi was amongst the first world leaders to congratulate the Zionist leader on his recent election success.
Narendra Modi, the leader of India's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, in July 2017 became the country's first prime minister to visit Tel Aviv, where he signed a series of agreements with his Israeli counterpart. After Netanyahu's ouster, ties between the two sides witnessed a slightly downward curve. Now, as the former premier is set to reclaim the chair, Hindutva hawks in New Delhi are rejoicing. Earlier this month, after Yair Lapid conceded defeat in the regime's general elections, Modi dialed Netanyahu and said he looked forward to deepening relations with Israel.
There is a long-standing history between the fascist Indian government, a Hindutva government right now in power at New Delhi, and the hardline government which has come into power now in the shape of Netanyahu in Israel, because, and you would definitely ask what those similarities are. Their similarities are very well known, historically established. That is the similarity between Palestine and Kashmir, because the both of the states have been cooperating in the past to control the population, the demographics of their respective regions under their occupations. And there is a common, phobia, that is Islamophobia, amongst both the leaders. So I do see this relationship further strengthening in the future as well.
Under Modi's leadership, India's military and economic ties with the regime in Tel Aviv have taken a new form and shape. The two sides signed a lucrative deal worth $2 billion in 2017 in what the Israeli officials termed the largest military deal in its history. Today, Israel contributes 40% of India's arms imports. More recently, Netanyahu used his personal rapport with world leaders, including Modi, to present himself as an international figure to Israeli voters and coalition allies. Pertinently, his new term in office coincides with the 30th anniversary of Indo-Israel diplomatic ties, which Modi has taken to newer heights in the past 8 years, adopting a different line from his predecessors.
It's a very interesting contrast, and at the same time, there you find similarity there as well. The father of this Hindutva concept, which is not a religious concept, but a political ideology, of a Hindu far right, I would say. The political forefathers of this ideology is Savarkar. He is, inspiration from Hitler. And right now, the concept of Zionism is based upon the domination of the racial domination of the Jews. That is, again, strangely enough, ironically enough, is influenced by the ideology of Hitler and by the ideology of the Nazi era. And now the contrast is the similarity in both Hinduism and the Hindutva and Zionism. That's how, irrespective of being in contrast with their origins, they are similar with each other. They draw inspiration from each other because both are working towards the subjugation of the Muslim population within their respective occupation. So that is why they draw inspiration from each other right now at this particular time. And there are ground realities existing since last, one decade in particular. Israeli Zionist regime is helping out the Hindutva Indian regime in controlling the demography of Kashmir on the basis of the model they had implemented on Palestine.
India has developed close ties with Persian Gulf countries over the past few decades. But the growing proximity between Israeli regime and India, especially during the tenure of Narendra Modi, remains a matter of concern and threat. There is a growing opinion in the Persian Gulf region that Modi and Netanyahu must not be allowed to use their proximity to advance the common narrative of Islamophobia and fascism in the region. The threat has become more pronounced after the recent arrest of Indians working for the Israeli spy agency in Qatar.
India's growing influence in the Persian Gulf region and at the same time its closer ties with the Israeli regime has become both a matter of concern and threat. In recent weeks, reports have been doing rounds about the detention of 8 former Indian Navy officers in Qatar on charges of espionage and international terrorism at the behest of the Israeli regime. They were allegedly transferring data from a major Persian Gulf country to the Israeli regime and India, which reveals a deeply sinister collaboration between the two sides that boasts of similarly toxic political ideologies.
You see, there is a history of intelligence cooperation and defense cooperation between India and Israel. The Indians have been buying the gadgetry, in particular the radars and the intelligence equipment from the Israelis, software from the Israelis as well. They've been getting training from the Israelis as well. And in return, what they're providing them is the vast manpower they've got in the Middle East, especially in the Gulf countries. They've not only have got simple manpower, but their Indians are placed in highly placed positions and important positions with the strategic positions within the governments of the Gulf countries and within the market economy of the Gulf countries and business leaders and big companies of the Gulf countries. The Indians are placed there. They've got access to information. And the intelligence cooperation thus is providing, they are at one hand getting the sophisticated equipment, the advanced equipment from Israel, the hardware from Israel. And in return, they're providing manpower to the Israelis, which they lack in the Gulf countries, to gain this intelligence, and Israeli spies who were caught in Qatar recently, which you've just questioned me about, are an example of this fact that they were all Indians.
The relationship between India and Israel has often been described as an outcome of the convergence of two hate-driven Islamophobic ideologies, Hindutva and Zionism. Therefore, the BJP-ruled India's growing military and strategic ties with Israel are seen as more ideological than pragmatic. With the Persian Gulf region becoming the extended neighbor of India, both in terms of geographical proximity and strategic influence, it has become all the more necessary for countries in the region to prevent the Hindutva-Zionism alliance from inflicting damage. It will also jeopardize relations between India and Persian Gulf countries that have taken years to formalize.
The Indians have got a huge influence because of the market economy and because of the trained manpower, skilled labor they provide to the Gulf countries, which is required by them, I mean, which is an utmost requirement for their economy, one. And second, because the Indians are in strategic partnership with the U.S. right now, and the Americans hold the dominant influence on the Middle Eastern countries. So, and at the same time, the Middle Eastern countries, the Gulf countries, are also playing on both the sides. They want to keep everyone happy. They want to keep the Americans happy, the Israelis happy. And obviously, Indians are taking advantage of this particular situation, and they don't really fear an outlash because of what they are doing right now. I've told you the reasons.
So we looked at Netanyahu's comeback and the relations between the Indian Premier Narendra Modi and the Israeli leader. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Journalist Pia Kutz cites an Israeli official as saying that India and Israel enjoy good relations due to personal relationship between Modi and Netanyahu, but adds that it goes beyond the personal level. Sidhan Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, says Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi extended congratulations to Netanyahu on election victory, adding that the two sides celebrate 30 years of ties this year. A medical doctor, Asaf Bahaya, points out that 8 former senior Indian naval officers were arrested in Qatar for spying on behalf of the Israeli spy agency under the name of fake company called Dahara.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amid a rapidly exacerbating global energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine, Pakistan may also be staring at acute natural gas shortages this winter. The crisis has deepened this year in the country, with officials fearing that natural gas supplies may be limited to households in winter. Experts opine the fifth most populous country, which has been grappling with political uncertainty, soaring inflation and forex crisis, is left with no other option but to ration natural gas supply this winter.
The rapid surge in global gas prices fueled by the simmering war in Ukraine has pushed liquefied natural gas prices to record high in emerging markets. It has forced Pakistan, which is already reeling under a debilitating economy, to pay the most ever for spot shipments under long-term contracts, or even relinquish them altogether. Experts believe this shortfall means the country will suffer long power outages over the winter.
I think the first thing is that Pakistan has domestic gas, but it is not enough to meet its industrial and residential needs. So Pakistan, like many other countries, is a net importer of natural gas. And if it cannot import enough natural gas, then obviously it cannot meet the needs of its industrial and residential quarters. And I think that's exactly what is happening, that because of a bunch of reasons, Pakistan has been unable to import sufficient amount of natural gas. And that's why I think they're predicting that there will be extreme shortage, both in the industrial and the residential sectors. There are two main reasons why they won't be able to get the or import natural gas. Number one, that there is shortage in the international market because of so many reasons, particularly the Ukraine war at the top of it. And you know, there are sanctions on Iran and Russia. So I think there's because of Ukraine war, and then because of the sanctions, the international market of natural gas has been rigged for shortage. And poor countries like Pakistan, they suffer the most because, number one, they don't have the money to buy expensive natural gas. And number two, you know, enough natural gas is not available.
Over the last decade, countries such as Pakistan built natural gas strategies thinking that the fuel would be available in abundance and at a cheaper price. This year, however, the strategy failed as the liquefied natural gas rates soared. The options before Pakistan to address the issue of the gas crisis include purchasing it from Iran and Russia, the two countries under U.S. sanctions. So far, Islamabad has treaded cautiously, but reports suggest that it is now seriously considering both gas and oil imports from Iran and Russia. There are also indications suggesting that Pakistan is looking to proceed forward with the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India natural gas pipeline project to overcome the energy crisis in the country. Pakistani media reports say the country's officials have been visiting different regional countries for the past month to find a solution to the gas crisis.
Pakistan will suffer a lot because Pakistan, you know, does not have enough energy. I mean, energy comes primarily, you know, for modern industries in the form of electricity and natural gas. Now, you need natural gas both for consumption and for running the industries, as well as for generating power. So if you don't have enough natural gas, you won't be able to produce electricity. Because of the shortage, I think the industrialists, they are worried that they won't have enough natural gas to run their machineries, and therefore they will be out of business. So I think their concern is extremely legitimate. The other fundamental thing that must be, you know, kept in mind is that Pakistan does not have foreign reserves, which means they do not have enough dollars and euros and other hard currencies. I mean, they're always at the brink of, you know, default. And so people, particularly the suppliers of natural gas, I think if they have a choice to give it to Pakistan or to Germany, or to Germany, because they think that Germany has, you know, much more, you know, reliable capacity to pay them for the natural gas, but Pakistan does not. So Pakistan seems to me in a big trouble because of so many things have gone wrong. And on top of it is that they don't have enough foreign reserves, which means that they spend more dollars than they get through their exports. I think their exports are very, very low. I think most of the foreign reserves they get are through workers working in foreign countries, particularly in the Gulf states and in Europe. So I think the lack of foreign reserves is a big factor in not getting natural gas. And obviously, the Ukraine war has complicated, you know, a lot of things because of the tension between Russia and the West. The natural gas that the European countries were getting, you know, it's no longer available. So they are turning to the Gulf states and to other, you know, suppliers of natural gas. And I think the suppliers would rather give natural gas to European countries than to countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh. So it's pretty bad situation that you don't have the foreign reserves, you don't have market credibility, and number three, there's shortage of natural gas because of the Ukraine war. And therefore, the poor countries will suffer the most And I think that's, you know, that adds to the problems of Pakistan.
The gas crisis in Pakistan is combined with domestic political instability and a fledgling economy amid stern warnings from rating agencies that the government must take hard decisions to avoid default. The country now finds itself at loggerheads, unable to import energy at the current skyrocketing prices. The country's depleting currency and rising liquefied natural gas prices have impacted finances, with foreign exchange reserves down in October to the lowest level in more than 3 years.
According to a report, at least 78% of households in Pakistan have no access to natural gas, while exploration and production have significantly decreased in the country. Pakistan Institute of Development Economics, in its recent search on the gas crisis in the country, said the country's indigenous oil reserves will be exhausted by 2025, with circular debt in the gas sector crossing 1.5 trillion rupees, citing politically influenced allocations and monopolistic business operations as bottlenecks. Natural gas and imported liquefied natural gas contribute more than 40% to the country's current energy mix, including gas resources used in electricity generation.
Let me first explain that there are two methods to import gas from foreign sources. One is through pipeline, which is on-ground pipeline that transports gas from the source to the country where it is needed. The other method of transportation is by ship. So the source country, they liquefy the gas, put it in a ship, and then the ship takes that gas to the country where it is needed, like Pakistan, and then that liquefied natural gas, called LNG, is regasified, which is pretty complex process. So always, if you have a choice between pipeline gas and liquefied natural gas, you would always prefer pipeline gas because it's cheaper and it's less complex. Because in the case of liquefied natural gas, first you have to make it into liquid, and then you have to regasify it. But in the case of pipeline, it is much easier to transport gas without liquefying. So Pakistan has two choices. One is to get the pipeline gas from Iran, which is the neighboring country, or to get it from Turkmenistan, which is on the west or northwest of Afghanistan. So if Pakistan gets natural gas from Iran, then there are only two parties, Iran and Pakistan. The source, which is Iran, and Pakistan, which is the user.
Large parts of the country remain unexplored due to security concerns and precarious law and order situation. The political instability in the country has also aggravated the gas crisis. The incumbent government has blamed the previous administration for the crisis. Pakistan's Petroleum Ministry officials claim that Imran Khan's government opposed gas import and failed to bring the cheapest available liquefied natural gas at the time, which impacted domestic gas production in the country. High spot rates for liquefied natural gas have discouraged many buyers in Asia, including Pakistan. All activities in the gas sector in Pakistan remain firmly under government control.
Political instability is a big factor. I think it seems like Pakistan, ever since its founding 75 years ago, it is always on the brink of economic collapse and at the brink of political collapse. The political system has not worked. And I think frequently the military, they intervene and they disturb the political system. And then they also disturb the economic policies. So I think because of lack of political stability, the economic policies cannot be pursued.
And that was Pakistan's gas crisis amid soaring inflation and the harsh winter ahead. Now, let's take a look at what people had to say on social media.
Afzal Kamal, a broadcast journalist, quotes from Dawn editorial that if Pakistan wants to tackle the gas crunch, it must focus on early domestic gas discoveries or continue to ration gas. Indian business journalist Dipanjan Chowdhury writes on Pakistan's impending gas crisis, noting that the increase in energy demands and depleting resources have led to crisis at hand. Burk Shah Zeb, a political activist, says Pakistani finance minister is busy holding consultations for next army chief, while the country's largest default risk reached 80%. Inflation is at a record level and massive gas load shedding is planned.
We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel has intensified its brutalities against Palestinians in the month of November.